Good morning, everyone. We're a couple of minutes late this morning, and it makes me realize we had a little techie issue. Not the techies, but the techies saved it. It makes me realize how often we broadcast and how rarely we have problems, and how grateful I am to all the people who help and make that happen and who invented the systems and all the other things. One Christmas Eve night at our Ananda Church, we've always done this really lavish Christmas Eve program, and we're going to do another one, but slightly different, of course, because we're a TV studio now rather than a gathering place at this 2020 Christmas. But one Christmas Eve, the singers got a little confused on the note and had to start over again. And it was practically the only time, perhaps the only time I could think of, where the singers actually missed the starting note and had to begin. I mean, not that it's never happened to an individual, but in a situation like that, and sometimes we make it look easy when it isn't really, when it's really just us, you know, with the desperate prayer and the power of the masters behind us. Every time anybody compliments me on any kind of a program that I give, I say every single program that I give, regardless of the announced topic, is actually a scientific demonstration of the power of desperate prayer. And that's really sort of how we're all working. We're all just in the hands of God, and every once in a while he teases us. So we're 3 minutes late. Those of you watching it not in real time won't even know, but it reminded me how grateful I am, both for community, for satsang, for the help of our guru bhais, and for the blessing of the masters, who stand behind everything we do, or else it would be impossible. But it seems to keep happening, so I guess it's what they want, which is, of course, the greatest joy of all. So, with that attitude of gratitude, let's pray. Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, Friend, Beloved God, Jesus Christ, Babaji Krishna, Lahiri Mahashaya, Swami Sri Yukteswar, beloved Master Paramhansa Yogananda, saints of all religions, humbly we bow to you all, dearest friend Swami Kriyananda. Bless us with an understanding of your words, your vision of our spiritual potential was always unlimited. You called us great souls, even in the most casual conversation, always affirming what you see and what we know to be, how we seem in Master's eyes. We are divine children. And if we open our hearts, when we open our hearts, to whatever extent we're able to, we know that you will come and you will guide us and help us. This, of course, is the greatest joy and the greatest blessing of our lives. Om. Peace. Amen. Well, my friends, I bought a nifty new tool. Look at that. Because one of my friends, Dambara, who's always looking like me to improve things, observed that the on and off with the glasses is really a big issue. So this is a giant magnifying glass of relatively dubious quality, but nonetheless more than adequate, so that I can point it at the tiny print of a book and then look up at you and not be doing this all the time. So today is its maiden voyage, and we're going to see how this works. I had my ever since I was 9 years old, I had to wear glasses. And then I guess it was almost 20 years ago when that LASIK surgery first started, Swamiji went right to it. And, you know, when all the rest of us were a little nervous, he went right to it and had his eyes lasered right away so that he could have distance vision. He always felt it was better for us not to wear glasses because they were a barrier with people. Nowadays, they make glasses so thin and so transparent, you hardly even see them on a person's face, but still, it's a barrier. So 20 years ago, I went out and had my eyes changed, which was really the miracle of modern science. I walked in. What happened was, you're wide awake. They give you I took a Valium because I was a little nervous, but you don't really need it. You're just wide awake. They spend a couple of minutes And then you open your eyes and I could see the clock across the room. It's very hard to explain to a person who hasn't been myopic their entire life since childhood what it means to just look across the room and be able to read a clock. But the immediate need was then for reading glasses. Somehow there was some kind of a trade-off, which was well worth it. So now I've been liberated even from reading glasses. So we'll see how this works. You know, if you hear me stumbling and saying really weird things, send me a note. Oh, yeah, I have it backwards, whatever it is I'm trying to do. So here we are. Now, here's where we are with what we're actually doing. This is being recorded on a Monday morning, and so many things happen here, meaning my life. Just and everything is its own thing. You have to put your mind into each thing completely. When Swamiji was writing books, which he would do periodically, the reason I phrased it like that is because sometimes he'd write music, sometimes he'd write books, sometimes he'd be on lecture tours, sometimes they would combine, but often he was one-pointed. But when he was writing a book, he said, no matter what he did, his mind was always on it, but he couldn't counsel people. Because when he counseled someone, he had to leave everything else behind in order to be completely attuned to their consciousness, and then he would lose the thread of the book. Even if he were giving a lecture or a class or something, he could still keep the thread of the book going in his mind because it was all words. And often, of course, he would weave what he was writing into what he was saying. But in the being who I am and the life that we live here, you know, there's a Saturday morning program, and then there's a meeting with people, and then there's a Sunday morning service, and so on. So by the time I just come downstairs, because this is just my living room, as many of you know, by the time I come downstairs, it's like, what day is it? Where am I? What am I doing? And then I fortunately leave the book out. I find the book, and then where am I in this book? You know, what was the point? And all these different things happen. So here we are. And now I remember, because God always reminds us. Superconscious remembers, and when we need to know, we know. We've been talking about mistakes. We've been talking about how to live in this world without creating bondage. It's as simple as that. How to work out and free ourselves from karma, instead of living in such a way that the karmic entanglements just tighten around us. And the reason this matters, reincarnation is one of the reasons it matters, but the reason reincarnation matters is because of our state of consciousness. The only thing that matters is our state of consciousness. And the reason it's the only thing that matters is because it's the only thing we ever actually experience. In this context and in other contexts, I've mentioned that I've been in a comparative quarantine, not absolute, but fairly strict, because I have the luxury to be able to do it since my life emanates from where I live. And therefore, the easy distractions that were built into my life until the middle of March last year, this year, last spring, until the middle of March, I just don't have them now. And I've never been a gad-about-town sort of person or a social butterfly. When everything is even, I just go quietly back to my room and I'm quite happy there. But nonetheless, there was always a safety valve. My big outing would be that I would take myself out to breakfast alone, you know, and take a good book and go sit in the counter of my favorite restaurant and let them cook breakfast for me, which I thoroughly enjoyed. Even though the restaurants are somewhat open, it's a little bit outside my my life plan at this point, or the plan that's imposed upon me. But just what that meant is that the problems of consciousness have to be confronted on the level of consciousness. Which is, of course, that's what death is about. That was one of the most profound pieces of advice that I heard from Stephen Levine 40 years ago when he was pioneering hospice work. And he said, you know, we're accustomed to solving the problems of consciousness by doing something through our physical body. the mind becomes restless, the heart becomes restless, the consciousness becomes unsettled. That's what we're talking about. And I think I'll just go out to breakfast and read a novel. And so there's a waffle in the consciousness, but I walk somewhere and I get in the car and I go and I sit and I distract myself. And then Stephen Levine spoke of the very simple fact that when your body stops obeying your will, and you simply don't have the option of picking up your body and taking it somewhere where the atmosphere is different and doing things through your body, and he's talking about your deathbed, he said the problems of consciousness have to be confronted and solved on the level of consciousness. And that mantra is how I would take it, has really stuck with me ever since. And even when I am just taking myself out to breakfast, calling a friend, doing any one of the other, you know, relatively uplifting things that I do because that's my taste anyway. But I'm always vaguely conscious, oh yes, problem of consciousness being solved on another level. And then I have devoted myself insofar as I am able, you know, to as much as possible solve the problems of consciousness on that level. Of course, you can sit to meditate, you can chant, you can read a spiritual book. You know, there's many levels before you go out to breakfast with a novel, which is, as I say, not such a terrible thing to do in any case. But to remain aware, this is what I'm doing. Then take Divine Mother with you. Swamiji lived a very natural life. We've never had a very restricted reality because Swamiji showed us, he modeled us a natural way to live. But what this whole series that we're talking about, finishing the race, is what if, or not what if, but when all problems have to be solved on the level of consciousness. It's a little late to be learning it, and it would be a good idea to have practiced when it was easier, so that when that time comes, we'll know exactly what to do, and we won't be torn up with waves of feeling and thought just washing over us without us having any idea how to direct or master them or even which way is forward on it. It's a very high-level training that we're talking about here. Swamiji doesn't mess around. So what we've been talking about mostly in the last couple of days has been about errors, honest, actual mistakes that we've made, and how do we regard our shortcomings. So I think we've gone as far as we need to go on that. So now Swamiji has this sort of like, here's how we continue. And so he says, so view whatever you've done as having been done by God, acting through your dream existence. Now this essay of Swamiji is one of those where he has climbed to the top of a range of mountains, and he's just walking across the top of the mountains. And he's not necessarily going all the way down into the valleys and showing us every step how he got all the way up to the top. Like this very sentence, view whatever you've done as having been done by God through your dream existence. Well, that's a lifetime of meditation right there. Like, who am I? Who is acting through me? What is this life force? You know, I identify with it. I think of it as my own. I think of it even as being my willful decision. But is it really? And is this existence really happening just because I'm awake and there's a consistency from day to day and year to year? Does that make it any less a dream just because it seemingly has gone on for a long time? And if we think about our subconscious dream state, our sleeping dream state, any condition that we can imagine can be replicated in the dream state, the subconscious dream state, and will seem perfectly reasonable to us at the time. I remember having a dream that was relatively serious about something or another, and then, to use Swami's phrase, and then suddenly there was a Volkswagen full of banana nut muffins, you know, sort of coming down the road, which is just a humorous way of saying that the subconscious just gets involved and all the images go kind of wonkus from objective reality. But it's very convincing Seems perfectly reasonable that a banana nut muffin could be driving a Volkswagen in a dream, just as it seems very reasonable in this dream for me to be able to remember being a child and all the things that happened in between. But if I were to suddenly wake up, I would perceive it as a dream. And no matter how convincing it was, I would perceive suddenly that it was just a dream. That's what Swami said. We will suddenly wake up and realize that even though we experienced it, what we're experiencing was not what we thought it was. So this is what we're trying to understand before we're forcibly taken out of our bodies and we have to realize that it was very different than we thought it was, is that we need to get ready for that. So this is now Swami's helping us to see that God is acting through us and that this is just a dream existence. So what he says, here's one way to start. Think of everything that seems to you attractive. Next, withdraw your energy from that attraction and concentrate inwardly on the superior appeal of soul bliss. Bliss is the higher, the true alternative to every outward attraction. In soul bliss, yes, even in the anticipation of it, notice how sensory attractions, by comparison, simply disappear. You will find it relatively easy at this point in your reflection to offer up lesser attractions to God. You will find it relatively easier at this point. Yeah, relatively easier. I love Swami's optimism. I spoke at the beginning of this talk about how Swamiji always used to address us as great souls. And there was never a hint of irony in it. He never said, good morning, great soul. He never said it like that. It was, hello, great souls. Just like as if it was our name. And it was our name to him. And in fact, it's true. All of us have this greatness in it. So now Swami's talking to us. And this is, we can wait until we're on our deathbed and we're trying to break our attachment to the people that we've loved in the form that we have loved them. Or we can practice now. And we can practice now with the things we're attracted to that God hasn't given us yet, and trying to get over disappointment and trying not to go on with thwarted longing, which is going to really be a karmic bondage that's going to have to play itself out for a very long time. So he's trying to get us to get a higher perspective on what we're attracted to and why we are attracted to it. Now, Swami just tells you, compare it to soul bliss. Even the anticipation of soul bliss, even the promise of. And yes, there is a tremendous amount of power there. I'm not going to denigrate it even for a second. This is how I have worked with it, and it may be helpful to you to think like this. Much of the time, and that's being very generous to myself, much of the time I am not in a state of soul bliss. By the grace of God, my center of gravity, so to speak, as we talk about it in the Education for Life system, is relatively light. Not everyone has a light center of gravity, but when all thwarting cross currents of agony are removed, my little bubble of consciousness tends to sort of rise high. It's more like a cork, it's not a stone. It doesn't just plunge. Now, some of you may have a plunging center of gravity, and that's a whole other issue that we'll have to work with in another way. But let's say we have a relatively light center of gravity. But still, I can feel within myself countless pulls in countless directions. All the vrittis are there. What am I attracted to? And so the beginning is just to ask ourselves, not even who do I love, what am I attached to, but even what am I attracted to? I'm attracted to having friends in my life. I'm attracted to having my friends be loyal to me. I'm attracted to having a comfortable home to live in. I'm attracted to my nice little bed with my nice little clean sheets and my pillow just the way I want it. You know, I'm attracted to the idea of having a life companion of a certain type. I'm attracted to being recognized for good work. I'm attracted to not being criticized by people. I'm attracted to being praised. I mean, huge list. So what I found helpful is I asked myself, why am I attracted to it? What is it that I think will come to me if I have this particular thing? Because now here we have to realize we're always trying to get a certain state of consciousness. This takes me back to the problems of consciousness. We're always trying to have a certain inner experience, no matter what we call it, no matter how we externalize it. When you really start thinking about it, the reason you want all of these conditions is because of the way it makes you feel inside yourself, the thoughts that you have, the attitude that you have, but it's always happening inside yourself. Therefore, every issue is an issue of consciousness. So if my friends praise me, how does that make me feel? Why is that attractive to me? Because then I get to feel like a worthwhile person. I get to feel that I'm not alone in this world. I get to feel that there are people who take care of me if I run out of money and have no place to live. It makes up for all the people who didn't like me. I can look at the one who criticized me and say, ha ha, you were wrong. See, all these people feel differently. It's a long story. But the first question is, what do I think this is going to bring me? This is the generic question. I'm attracted to that. I want that. I think it's appealing to me. Because, why? Not just, oh, well, she's pretty and everybody wants a life companion. Don't be glib. Be actually deep inside yourself. What do I think will happen if that attraction is fulfilled? And how will it make me feel? And why do I think that's a good thing? Now, these are not questions you answer like, 30 seconds. These are questions that you sit with for a long time. And what do I think it will bring me? And don't try to give an answer that you think is the answer that somebody other than you wants. And there's nobody in your head but you. Well, actually, you and God. This is just between you and you. Like, what do I really, from the deepest part of myself, feel? Now, the ultimate objective here is for us to, quote, pass the final exam by just letting go of all attachments and all delusions. But we can get an 81 and still be doing fine on this. We don't have to get 100%. But moving toward 100% is self-honesty. Self-honesty is really the first criteria of whether we pass or fail this. Because when everything else, all the props are taken away, all that we're left with is whatever our consciousness actually is. So there's no point in pretending that it's not. But even just to say, I'm really attracted to this because, for example, deep inside of me, I really don't feel lovable. And so I constantly need other people to reassure me that I am a desirable person in this world. This is a proposal. It's not necessarily a true confession on my part. It's just one way that that question could be answered. Why do I think I'm not lovable? Well, we may have psychological answers, but there's also fundamental spiritual answers. All the saints and masters assure us that we are unconditionally loved by God. Why am I not experiencing that? What is holding me back? I've shared with you on other occasions an experience I had in seclusion in which I was trying to receive the love of Divine Mother, and I realized that I was holding a great many vibrations that were completely contrary to unconditional love. Mostly it was the attitudes I was projecting outward, and therefore I was dissonant with the vibration of Divine Mother's love. Why don't I feel loved? Well, because I'm still mad at this person and I'm still mad at that person. And so I live in a world in which love is conditional. So when I try to experience unconditional love, I don't really know what that is, because I'm so busy being conditional in the love that I offer. That has nothing to do with what I'm attracted to. It's completely unrelated. It's just the story that I've spun and therefore the consciousness I'm living in. So what Swamiji is asking us to do is to take each thing that we're attracted to, trace it back to its source, and then, if he suggests very directly, compare whatever fulfillment we think that might give us with what we can, at least with our imagination, think what it would feel like to be unconditionally loved by God. I remember in one day in particular, I was trying to feel what it would be like to be absolutely unafraid, because that's a state of consciousness that the Masters promise us, to be absolutely unafraid. It's not anything that let me phrase it differently. I've only rarely brought myself to the point of absolute fearlessness. But even one time, it gives me a feeling for it. Even one time, when your soul has been completely at one with the Divine Spirit, even one time in which we have been lifted above the experiences of this world, gives us the point of comparison. And so when we feel this attraction, whatever it might be, and then we compare it to what perfect love might be, perfect fulfillment might be, then, as Swami says, it's relatively easy then to let go of that attraction, because everything that we're seeking is always a substitute for the perfect fulfillment of the heart. Saint Augustine said, "The heart is restless till it finds its rest in thee." And that's what we want to begin to explore. Why is my heart restless? What am I truly seeking? And how best will I find that? And so that's the beginning. God bless you, my friends.